my dad is a retired internist. He used to have this aphorism that he would tell his residents, which is never say PE out loud unless you mean it. For that same reason, once it like enters your brain, you can't get rid of it.
Welcome back to Last Week in Medicine. Happy second impeachment day. They say the second one is easier. I'm Stephen Jenkins, and today I'm honored to welcome back Dr. Austin Rupp, who is now a proud father. Hey, Austin.
Yeah, that's Dr. Papa Rupp from now on, I guess. I don't know. Yes, thank you. Glad to be back. You did a great job in my absence. So I'm clearly quite dispensable, but thanks for sticking with me, Dr. Jenkins.
We also have a special returning guest, a friend of the pod, Dr. Jason Carr, pulmonology critical care fellow. Welcome back, Jason.
Thanks. Good to be back. Congrats, Austin.
Thank you. Thank you. So Jason's coming to us live from the new pulmonary clinic in the E as in Edward building, good naming system, University of Utah. maybe you should take that out. But anyway, thanks for being here, dude. Who came up with that? I mean, come on, there's a B, a D, and an E, and they all sound identical.
Well, we should probably go to, like, you know, what the military or police do and say, like, Echo and Delta. I don't know.
Right. The phonetic alphabet. Yeah, yeah. We became very much like an airport, but without the McDonald's or the newsstand.
I definitely want to petition for a McDonald's in the hospital system. Wow. Jenkins and I both love McDonald's. I'm not sure where you come down on that, Jason, but cats out of the bag. We love
it. It is a guilty pleasure of mine to get the buttermilk chicken sandwich meal. It's all about the fries, obviously. But for you guys, I don't know if you've ever been to the Vanderbilt University campus, and maybe some of your listeners have. They used to, at least, have a McDonald's on their hospital campus. It was incredible.
Yeah, I can see the wisdom in not doing that, but I do love a good McTummy ache sometimes. And that the all, you know, every size of drink is a dollar. Come on, that is just, you just lure me in there. That's just not fair.
That's a Mormon thing, isn't it? The drinks. I mean, you guys love your drinks.
We love our soda.
Yeah. Yeah.
Having been to Swig recently, though, I got to admit, it's decent. I don't know that I'm going to go back a lot, but it was pretty good.
Well, I think, you know, we should note that 10 Republicans voted to impeach the president today. That's neat. The most bipartisan impeachment in the history of America.
Didn't know that part.
Here.
I enjoyed watching every minute of it.
I think also, you know, as an aside, Mitt's making us proud still, right? I mean, he's like out there, you know, in the trenches hating on Trump. Like,
he did give a nice speech. I liked his speech that he gave, you know, a week ago when the insurrection happened.
But, right. So this is the first recording since terrorists tried to occupy the Capitol, right?
Well, no, Danny and I recorded one the same day. We were both like a little like, should we still do this? Like, this is not a great day, but, you know, we're committed to the pod, so I made her do it.
But then you didn't. How did you not go on a rant?
We did the rant before I hit record. That's what happened. Hey, so what's it like being a dad, Austin? Tell us about baby Gus.
Baby Gus is great. Baby Gus was August, is his full name, but Gus in our hearts and minds. Born on January 1st, healthy. Kirsten did amazing. We showed up at 9-ish, and he was delivered at like 2:30 a.m. And yeah, I mean, you know, the hospital's was fairly... was a blur. I don't remember what happened there, but nothing too bad. And then he did get Billy lights for like half a day, but it was really weird. They like told us that he needed Billy Lights based on a new University of Utah hyperbilirubinemia kernicterus curve therapy, yada, yada, yada. And then 20 minutes later, they came back and were like, he doesn't need lights, but he was already under the lights. So then we decided to do the lights.
So we're still going to bill you for it.
Yeah, maybe this is an indictment of I'm not trying to, you know, talk smack on our PEDS colleagues, but that was a bit of a cluster. But he did get the lights. And since he's been home, he's been great. I mean, you know, he does baby stuff. He has tried to poop and pee on me several times. You know, he cries. He does things that babies do. But so far, so good, really. I mean, Kirsten obviously takes the brunt of things. And, you know, I am able to sleep through his cries sometimes. And she has to, you know, feed him. And maybe I'm being an absent slacker father, but she's doing a great job. And, you know, he seems like a good kid.
That's why they say, you know, you don't sleep like a baby, you sleep like a father. No one's more soundly than a father.
There you go.
Yeah, that's the worst, is when you're like trying to change a baby boy's diaper and you open up the diaper and then he just starts peeing on you. You're like, whoa, where'd that come from, buddy?
Yeah, yeah. We've I've dodged several bodily, you know, fluids in the last couple of weeks, but getting pretty adept and pretty quick at it. So hopefully that continues. The dogs are also good, you know, coming live from Rupp's Kennels. They don't seem to mind him too much. Like, I think it took 12 hours for Ozzy to realize that he was staying and that there was a baby in the house. And then, like, then when he would cry, Ozzy would first bark, then grab his toy, then like run away. So he wasn't quite sure what to do. And Theo has sort of a curious avoidance. He like Gus will cry and Theo will sniff him a little bit and then he'll kind of like run away also. So, that seems like a good reaction to something that you don't know, you know, that scares.
It sounds like Gus is asserting his dominance in the pack though, which is a good sign.
Alpha
is coming in strong.
Yeah. Gus is alpha. But yeah, I mean, our Kirsten's parents are in town, so we've had a lot of help there, which has been good. And yeah, I mean, it's, you know, big life adjustment, but so far so good. Glad to have the support of the pod.
How's fellowship going, Jason? Almost done.
Only 6 more months. Yeah, no, it's never going out with a bang. You know, COVID changed everything. That's all I can say. Man, if you had asked me a year ago what I thought the last year of fellowship would have been like, I don't think I ever could have imagined this, but it's been a little, you know, good in some ways, a little extra clinical experience, but disappointing in other ways where it feels like everything is COVID kind of all the time. But on the other hand, as a third year fellow, I came into this with a lot of skills and the opportunity to help out in a lot of different ways. And it's been rewarding to kind of be, you know, recognized for that and kind of be called upon. It feels a little bit like you're chipping in a lot. And I know the hospitalists who've been carrying, you know, a ton of the acute care load, you know, hopefully feel the same way. Doing an enormous service for kind of the whole hospital to keep things running. And, but yeah, it's, you know, hopefully by the time I graduate, things will be a little further along and getting this pandemic behind us. But, and I've said that same thing every 3 months, and maybe with the change in leadership and the change in Congress, you know, the plan will change. Sounds like the state's plan and taking over COVID vaccinations may move things along as well. I think it's going to give a lot of our patients a lot more confidence, take the edge off the anxiety in the community. So there really does seem to be a light at the end of the tunnel.
Toast Elizabeth.
Yeah. Toast Elizabeth. Oh man, what a segue.
Did you guys get your second vaccination yet?
I did. And man, I have not. It wasn't that bad. You know, it was fine. But I haven't had body aches like that in a while. It's just, you know, felt like I did the world's hardest workout the day before or something. Took some ibuprofen, got better really quick. But it was an impressive reaction.
I didn't have that. I mean, I had, my arm was sore, but I didn't think it was noticeably different than the first dose, to be honest. Like, I was a little bit more tired and maybe got a headache, but I'm not sure if that was a ski tour or two beers that I drank too fast also. So maybe it was the vortex of all three that made me tired.
What about you, Jamie?
Having a newborn child and not getting enough sleep.
Yeah.
Right. I add that in as well. Yeah. But well,
I haven't got mine.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was just gonna. I haven't got mine yet. I'm getting it on Tuesday. So looking forward to the body aches, the headaches, etc. At least I'm not on service, so I can just sleep it off. Hope.
I don't think I was thinking a little bit of a segue. I bet there's not a group that's had more exposure than critical care fellows, like pulmonary critical care fellows. Like, especially a first year. I mean, a first year works in the ICU for basically 12 months straight without, you know, taking breaks, right? Like one day off a week for 12, like basically for, you know, 10, 11 months. Like there's probably just not a group that's had more sustained exposure to COVID than pulmonary critical care fellows.
Yeah, I think our first year fellows whose schedule really hasn't changed really do probably get a lot of exposure. You know, the nurses too, who, you know, our ICU nurses who have stuck it out with us, I mean to say, you know, they've had a lot of stress and a lot of opportunity to leave at times, and especially the group here that's stayed and been a consistent force for taking care of these patients, they have borne a lot of the risk. But I will special shout out here to the university and actually Intermountain and the VA, all the hospitals we rotate at. Our management systems here have been incredibly effective at getting us adequate PPE. We have been really well protected in the ICU since this all started. I mean, I think that's a consequence of a lot of long-term planning that they had going on, you know, before this, thinking about other potential pandemics. But, you know, we've been well protected throughout this whole experience, which I think has also given people the confidence they need to stay and be involved. So, yeah. You're right, though. The first year fellows love to throw them a extra big party in the year. They got to get something out of this.
Here's some pizza. Thank you for your service.
Oh man!
All right. Well, we've bantered enough. We probably need to get to the articles. So Austin's going to start us off with an interesting paper from JAMA.
Yes, I am. So this is the article. This article is titled "Prevalence of Pulmonary Embolism Among Patients with COPD Hospitalized with Acutely Worsening Respiratory Symptoms." It was by Couturod, maybe, from France, and group, and et al. And it was published in JAMA on January 5th, 2021. So, insert thrombosis joke here, I guess. You know, we here at Last Week in Medicine have a particular interest in thrombosis, and this paper caught our eye because this clinical scenario seems to crop up fairly often. You know, a patient is admitted with COPD or some other etiology for acutely worsening respiratory symptoms, and you think about PE, but you don't really know, you know, if you need to think about PE, and PE is kind of just one of those things that, like, if you think about it, you can't get it out of your head, and you're not sure if you should test for it, and it still remains very unclear sort of how often concomitant pathophysiologies exist together. So anyway, that's why we decided to talk about this paper. As we know, COPD causes significant morbidity and mortality, and exacerbations contribute to that morbidity and mortality significantly. And as sort of we just mentioned, there's an unclear prevalence of PE in COPD exacerbations. And diagnostic evaluation for PE in the presence of COPD exacerbations remains uncertain. Previous data have shown that the prevalence of PE is variable. There was a meta-analysis that showed that PE was positive or present in 16% of admissions for unexplained COPD exacerbations. And then a study of post-mortem, you know, analyses showed PE is the main cause of death in 21% of patients admitted with COPD exacerbations. So it remains a little bit unclear, and those are fairly high numbers. And so these guys, this group decided to take a look at this question. So they did a multi-center cross-sectional study with prospective follow-up across 7 centers in France from January 2014 to May 2017. Consecutive patients admitted with COPD exacerbations as confirmed the COPD was confirmed by an FEV1 to FVC ratio of less than 70%, or they were diagnosed with COPD by a pulmonologist. Those were the patients that were included. Exclusion criteria included a contraindication to CTPA, a creatinine clearance less than 30, pregnancy, hospitalization greater than 48 hours prior to inclusion, previous anticoagulation treatment or being on an anticoagulant, pneumothorax, and life expectancy less than 3 months. So that was kind of the major exclusion criteria. So patients were enrolled, and then they used a revised Geneva score to stratify the patients as high or non-high clinical probability of PE. We should note here that we don't really, or at least I personally don't use the revised Geneva score very often. Wells is kind of our go-to, at least institutionally. But anyway, they used the revised Geneva score to stratify folks. Patients who had a high probability, which was a score greater than or equal to 11, got a CTPA. And then low or intermediate probability, which was a score of less than 11, got D-dimer test. And then if the D-dimer was less than 500 PE, was effectively ruled out and they did not receive anticoagulation. This is a little bit of a point of contention for me. It's not totally clear what they protocolized or did with the D-dimer if it was greater than 500. The patients are all very sort of well explained in figure one. Like, there's a good flow sheet in the paper that shows what happened to folks, but they never sort of said what their protocol was. Like, some of them got CTPAs plus duplex, some of them got CTPA without duplex, most of them got CTPAs, but it wasn't clear what their actual sort of, concrete protocol was. Anyway, all patients were followed up at 3 months with a physician questionnaire, and all readmissions were investigated. The primary outcome was PE diagnosed within 48 hours of admission. If the CTPA was equivocal, PE was diagnosed based on VQ scan, ultrasound, or PE on autopsy, as an aside. There were several secondary outcomes. I thought the key one was PE within 3 months in patients without PE in the first 48 hours who did not receive anticoagulation. So that's kind of the background info on the study. 740 patients were ultimately included. It was notable to me that the diagnostic protocol was varied from in 139 patients, which is almost 19%. They do note that there was only quote unquote major diagnostic protocol variation in 16 instances, but thought that was notable. The results were that 17 patients out of the 740 were high risk by Geneva score. They found 5 PEs on CTPA, and then they found 2 patients with proximal DVT who were treated for a total of 7 venous thromboembolic events. And then there were 723 non-high clinical probability folks who had 712 D-dimers. Of those, 212 were less than 500, so VTE was effectively excluded. And then 500 had a positive D-dimer, which was defined again as greater than 500. Of those, 478 got CTPAs. They found 36 PEs, and then ultimately 8 DVTs within that group. It was notable to me that 11 patients within that group of patients who were not high on the Geneva score didn't get D-dimer testing. They just went straight to CTPA, and they had 3 PEs. So that's kind of number salad, obviously, and there's lots of additional numbers that I don't think are important, and you're probably not really listening at this point. So follow the flow sheet if you want to know what happened to each patient. They basically, of the 740 patients included, found 44 PEs, which is a 5.9% prevalence. They additionally found 10 patients who had isolated venous thromboembolic disease, a DVT, within 48 hours of admission. So the prevalence of venous thromboembolic disease or an event was 7.3%. So 5.9% for PE, 7.3% for VTE. A few other notable things: at the 3-month follow-up, of the 670 patients deemed not to have PE, 5 ended up getting diagnosed with PE, so that's 0.7%. Those diagnosed with PE within the 740 patients had a much higher 3-month mortality rate than those who were not diagnosed with PE, 25.9% versus 5.2%. They do talk a little bit about physicians and whether or not they suspected PE and had high probability or thought it was the most likely diagnosis. So we'll talk about that, I guess, briefly. You know, 30 of 299 patients who were suspected of having a PE, who the physician expected or suspected of having a PE, had PE. So 10%. We were right, you know, physicians were right 10% of the time. And then 14 of 441 who were not suspected of having a PE did have a PE, so 3.2%, which is probably higher than it should be. And then 22 of 173, so 12.7%, physicians said that they thought PE was the most likely diagnosis, so they were right 12.7% of the time. And then, you know, the 22 of 567 patients whom physicians thought had something else had a PE. So that probably doesn't make any sense, but we'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. And I think, you know, for me, the prevalence here of PE and COPD exacerbations was 5.9%. That's the biggest takeaway. We, again, use a Wells score more often at the University of Utah. So, you know, not totally clear how this would translate to our practice. This was a pretty large study, but there were some deviations from the diagnostic algorithm, which I think is notable. Physicians, you know, still don't really know when folks have PE and when they don't, is kind of what I took from the physician and whether or not they suspected it and thought it was the most likely diagnosis, yada, yada, yada. So we still don't really know what we're talking about is kind of what that said to me. And then, you know, the duplex, data was a little bit kind of willy-nilly, and I don't think this really provides any guidance on when you should do duplex in the diagnostic algorithm and sort of where that fits in. But again, 5.9% of folks admitted with COPD exacerbations had PEs. So how you use that in your practice is a little bit to be determined. But I think it's probably still going to keep me up at night is my where I land.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting trial and something that I think people have been waiting for a while. I just have to echo something Austin said real quick. My dad is a retired internist. He used to have this aphorism that he would tell his residents, which is never say PE out loud unless you mean it. For that same reason, once it like enters your brain, you can't get rid of it. I think one of the really consistent themes that you alluded to at the end of this year is the performance of clinical decision support and how the different forms that can take. And this is yet another example that physicians are pretty good. We tend to have intuition. The intuition of the physicians in this trial wasn't terrible. They kind of did have a sense of who might be more likely to have a PE, but physician intuition plus, you know, systematic evaluation was always better. And it's probably better than systematic evaluation alone. You know, not everybody's going to need to be ruled out for PE and you need some physician judgment to be there for that. For those of you who like exploring this issue in particular, suggest reading outside of this, the Italian syncope PE trial from a couple years ago, which was an overall better trial because it was prospective and everybody got the same evaluation, but it's kind of similar feel and similar way of improving the way that we frame the presence of PE in a specific diagnosis. But this is, to my knowledge, the best paper to date that helps us out with this. There was one paper that circulated a while ago that suggested, you know, 20% of COPD exacerbations were from PE, and that entered the mindset of a lot of people and always felt like a little overkill. And this kind of confirms what we thought. I agree with Austin that, you know, if I were to mimic a protocol, I wouldn't do what they did where they seemed to get a DVT, you know, they went looking for DVTs even when they already had PEs in people. But that's a difference in systems, and they probably had their reasons for doing it. We wouldn't do that in our system. One thing that was a little disappointing for me about this trial is that I really wanted to see the rate of concurrent PE even when other diagnoses were present. So one of the tables in this paper breaks down the presence of the likely cause of the COPD exacerbation. And if the patient had a PE, they declared that as the cause of the COPD exacerbation. But they also go on to outline the presence of CHF exacerbations, bacterial pneumonia, which was the most common cause, as it usually is. And then they interestingly attributed a number of their exacerbations to DVTs, which, you know, anything is plausible, but that seemed to be a little, lazy as in they didn't try, but, you know, attributing a COPD exacerbation in the absence of the PE to the presence of an isolated DVT seems a little bit of a bold call to me. So one thing is that this is very helpful in is that it, and apparently in all comers, you know, the true rate, quote unquote, true rate of PE contributing to COPD exacerbation appears to be about 5 to 6%, which is great. That gives us a better sense of what to do and how often to go looking for these things. But I would have really liked to see how often PE was present concurrently with those other diagnoses, for one. And for two, I think a more interesting trial, and maybe they're planning this one, would have been a trial that mirrored the Italian syncope trial, where in patients who didn't have a bacterial pneumonia, who didn't have volume overload from heart failure, and who didn't have, you know, some apparent other cause of their exacerbation, what is the presence of PE in that population? And it might be high. And getting that breakdown, even with these patients, which is something that these authors could follow up on, would actually be pretty helpful, I think, in informing the way we evaluate these patients. A couple other things that I thought were interesting, about 8% of the patients each had cancer already existent, and another 8% had prior history of VTE. So this is a group that's kind of enriched for a history of VTE to begin with, which is not surprising with numerous comorbidities. And then, I think this is going to change the way we think about it. The big lesson for me here is to be systematic. In COPD exacerbations, it's probably worthwhile to perform the Geneva score and then to follow through on that with D-dimer and imaging where necessary. But I would emphasize some caution that if you have an obvious pneumonia, a positive COVID test, although that's a complicating factor nowadays, to maybe consider that as the most likely feature of diagnosis until we have other follow-up data. I don't know what other thoughts you guys have.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, anytime someone comes in with shortness of breath, like PE has to be on your mind. And that's the most common symptom in a COPD exacerbation. But it's so easy to anchor on just COPD, right? Like, oh, this is a patient with COPD, 50-pack year smoking history, whatever. It's got to be COPD exacerbation. And it was probably triggered by, you know, bronchitis or air pollution or whatever. And I think the ER is probably better than we as hospitalists are at, like, ruling out PE, because by the time we see these patients, a lot of them have already had CTPAs, right? And so I do think it's important, like, especially when you're talking with, like, staffing patients with residents and medical students, you know, to actually systematically go through that with them and say, are you worried about a PE in this patient? And if they say no, know that their clinician gestalt is probably worthless and that you should still go through the steps and calculate what either a well score or a Geneva score to figure out what their pretest probability is. Like, that should be your first step, like you were saying, Jason. I think it is interesting that they actually looked at clinician gestalt before they did that. And, you know, I thought the numbers were appalling. I thought the doctors actually did a pretty horrible job of predicting who had it and who didn't. And which is interesting because, like, the ER will use something like the PERC rule, which allows you to rule out a PE without even doing a D-dimer or CTPA. But you can only use the PERC rule if your gestalt is that they are low risk. Like, that was the original PERC rule, was, do you have a low suspicion for PE? Great, then use the PERC rule. Whereas I think it's always smarter to stick with these validated scoring systems like Wells or Geneva. The other thing I thought was interesting was they used this D-dimer cutoff of 500, which is pretty typical classic D-dimer cutoff. But we also have evidence that you can use age-adjusted D-dimer cutoffs. And they did go back and look at that and say, okay, if we had used age-adjusted D-dimers, they would have cut down on CT scans by 22%, which is not insignificant. But they would have missed 4 PEs if they had done that, and one fatal PE within 3 months. And so, you know, so there are some challenges with the age adjusted. We reviewed another paper last year that used 1,000 as the number for a cutoff if you had a low pretest probability, and it performed just as well as the 500 cutoff for patients with low pretest probability. So just something to keep in mind that, you know, 500 is what they use, but there are other cutoffs out there. Also interesting that of the patients who, they said 42% of adjudicated deaths in those with VTE were related to cancer. And so I think it's important when you have these patients come in with a COPD exacerbation, you find a PE, there's a pretty good chance they may have cancer too. So don't forget to go looking for that. But overall, yeah, I agree with you guys. I think this was a really interesting and helpful paper, and especially nailing down what we think the real rates are.
I'll just add on to that real quickly that interesting to note that the, you know, the rate of death amongst those who did have an identified PE was significantly higher. And we do know from other data that this is true as well, that, you know, patients who present with PE more likely to go on to be diagnosed with cancer, as you kind of mentioned, more likely to go on to have other complications. It's just a marker of badness, and to have, you know, achieving the diagnosis of PE is the start, not the end of where internists should be kind of considering what to do. So in my humble pulmonary and critical care opinion.
I think this just also still remains like two of the murkiest diagnoses. I mean, PE is not a murky diagnosis, right? But like senior Dr. Carr says, you know, it's one of those things that like is just sort of we use Gestalt probably more than we should, but it also just feels like something we should do. And then COPD in my clinical experience is also just sort of like a, you know, chart lore probably 80% of the time, right? Like if someone, whether or not, I mean, that wasn't these patients, but whether or not, you know, someone actually has COPD and then they might wheeze and then they say that their sputum has changed a little bit and then they, you know, have used their rescue inhaler a little bit more, which may or may not have been inappropriately, you know, given to them is still makes for a very murky picture. So it is, I think, you know, this is something nice to just have in your back pocket to say, like, here's some concrete data in a pretty well-defined population. You know, here's how they thought about it. Here's how maybe I should think about it. And it's part of the toolbox. So probably just, you know, repeating what you guys have said, but I want the last word. So next paper.
You get it.
Yeah. I think it's time to shift gears. Yeah, unfortunately, it's time to talk about tocilizumab.
No.
Yeah. So we first talked about this drug in our November 18th episode. Austin broke it down. The Back Bay trial was published online in the New England Journal on October 21st, and I naively thought that that would be the last time we talked about tocilizumab. It was a negative trial, so I was like, great, move on. Little did I know that there were a million other tocilizumab studies in progress and that three of them had actually already been published, and I just didn't know. So the day before Back Bay trial was published in the New England Journal, there were three other tocilizumab studies published online in JAMA Internal Medicine, and I think back in October, my mind was occupied with other things, mostly whether our country would re-elect a white supremacist fascist president. So I wasn't perusing the literature very much. It's mostly doom scrolling on Twitter. But all three of these studies were printed in the January issue of JAMA Internal Medicine, so we have a second chance to review them. And that way, when we talk about tocilizumab, we can tell the whole story, right?
So I thought in your email that these were all three the same trial. I looked at them and it was like, the title of one is like basically the same as the, anyway, sorry.
Yeah. They all have the same title, that's true. So we all identify them by their study names. But as everyone listening probably knows, tocilizumab is a humanized monoclonal antibody against IL-6 receptor. Lots of observational studies have shown a higher mortality rate in COVID-19 patients who have elevated IL-6 levels. So people immediately became interested in targeting IL-6 as a possible therapeutic option. And there's now several observational studies and some randomized control trials looking at tocilizumab. The first study I wanted to talk about today is the Stop COVID study by Gupta et al. It's a retrospective cohort study looking at 3,924 patients admitted to the ICU with COVID-19. They compared patients who got tocilizumab within 2 days which was 11% of patients, to those who did not. And there were pretty significant differences between those who got tocilizumab and those who did not. The tocilizumab patients were younger, they had fewer comorbidities, they had more severe hypoxemia, and they had more elevated inflammatory markers. The researchers tried to account for these differences with inverse probability weighting, and only, interestingly, only 19% of tocilizumab patients got steroids and 13% in the usual care group. So this was kind of before the recovery trial had changed our standard practice. The primary outcome they looked at was in-hospital death, which was 28.9% in the tocilizumab group and 40.6% in the usual care group, which was statistically significant. So that seems quite exciting, but as we all know, even with fancy statistical methods, you can't completely overcome the risk of residual confounding in observational studies. So who knows what you can really do with that information. What did you guys think about this study?
What I took away from this is intrigue more so than major conclusions. I think one of the challenges with tocilizumab is, like you said, that you know, it seems like all the stars seem to align for this therapy to be valuable based on this elevated IL-6 phenomenon. The one thing that I think people forget is that IL-6 is elevated in like every patient with critical illness. And in fact, in a lot of phase two trials in the critical care world, they frequently evaluate the response of IL-6 because it's this kind of non-specific marker of inflammation, but it's there in everybody and it gives you the opportunity to make some sort of broad assessment of these folks. This is kind of an attempt, I think, to generate good hypotheses is what I took away from it. It's interesting, but I agree that, you know, at the end of the day, it's an observational trial with some clever statistical methods and to attempt to account for that. But I don't think you can float that all away based on the results that they have. I would be more interested in, you know, a follow-up randomized controlled trial, especially given the cost of this therapy and the low certainty of, low magnitude of benefit given that cost.
Yeah, so obviously, like you just mentioned, we need randomized controlled trials to figure out if it really works, right? And so the first published randomized controlled trials were the RCT-TCZ COVID-19 trial and the Coramuno-TOCI-1 trial. So we'll start with RCT-TCZ COVID-19. This was by Salvarini et al. They came out of Italy. It's an open label randomized controlled trial, so no placebo, and with only 131 patients. They included patients with moderate to severe COVID-19 pneumonia who required oxygen, but not ICU level care. So basically floor patients. And their goal was to give tocilizumab early, within 8 hours of randomization, and then they gave a second dose within 12 hours, which is different than all the other studies. They excluded patients who were ineligible for ICU admission, which they defined as patients with advanced age and multiple comorbidities, and patients who were do not intubate. So this was during a period in Italy where they had to ration ICU care due to an overwhelming number of cases. I think we all remember that time in the news. So they actually deemed patients ineligible for ICU admission if they had advanced age and multiple comorbidities, and those patients were not eligible for this study. The primary outcome was clinical worsening within 14 days, which was defined as a composite of ICU admission requiring ventilation, death from any cause, and a PF ratio less than 150. The trial was stopped early by the Data and Safety Monitoring Board for futility because there was no difference in the primary outcome. The mortality rate was very low, 2.4%, which is a surprisingly low number, but that's probably because they excluded those older patients with comorbidities. Another weakness of this study was that 14 of the 60 patients assigned to usual care ended up getting tocilizumab because of clinical worsening. So it really, you know, limits your ability to interpret the results. But overall, this was a negative randomized controlled trial. What did you guys think about this one?
Oh, man. If you feel like you're swimming in tocilizumab soup right now and drowning, you're welcome to the party. It seems like everybody was appropriately trying to carve out a niche. Like you said, this kind of resulted in somewhat experiment of nature in Italy where, you know, people got divided along somewhat random lines. But I did not take a lot away from this. I'll be honest that my bias prior to reading this trial is that tocilizumab is likely of limited benefit. And this seemed to demonstrate that it is of limited benefit in a somewhat straightforward setting. So that's my headline takeaway. What about you, Austin?
Yeah, I have not gone on as deep a dive as probably both of you have as in regards to tocilizumab, but I think Josh Farkas with PulmCrit has a pretty good write-up on tocilizumab, and most of what I am going to say comes from that. But I think his main point here was that this, as Stephen alluded to, was pretty early on, and only 4% of patients in this trial received steroids. And so this is sort of the best non-steroid tocilizumab trial, you know, sort of individual therapy IL-6 blockade by itself that we have. And I think, you know, it was negative. I think it's negative. I think tocilizumab by itself doesn't do anything or isn't helpful, with the caveat that it's safe. And I think we'll see that across all these trials. But tocilizumab by itself didn't do much or anything, was my takeaway.
Yeah. So the next trial was the Coramuno TOSI-1 study. It enrolled hospitalized patients in France with moderate to severe COVID-19 pneumonia and an oxygen requirement. They excluded patients who needed high-flow nasal cannula, non-invasive ventilation, and mechanical ventilation. So it was a similar population as the last study, but they did not exclude older patients with comorbidities. So it's a little more generalizable. They gave the patients in the experimental arm 8 milligrams per kilogram of tocilizumab, and then on day 3, they could give another 400 milligrams if the patient's oxygen need had not decreased by 50%, and 47% of the patients got that second dose. One thing about this study is they used Bayesian statistical methods to assess efficacy, which is something I am definitely not used to. They had two primary outcomes. The first was a WHO clinical progression scale score greater than 5 at day 4, which basically means the patient is on high flow, non-invasive, or mechanical ventilation. And so 19% of the tocilizumab patients had a score over 5 at day 4 compared to 28% of usual care. But this did not meet the pre-specified threshold for significance. The other outcome was the posterior probability of improved survival without the need for non-invasive or mechanical ventilation by day 14, 24% of tocilizumab patients versus 36% of usual care patients had this outcome, and this outcome met the 95% threshold, but just barely at 95.05%. So what does that even mean? I think it means that maybe tocilizumab improves the likelihood that the patient will be alive and not on a ventilator in 14 days. But what about at 28 days? There was no difference in mortality. So they had one sort of positive primary outcome, one negative primary outcome, but no mortality benefit. So what did you guys think about that trial?
There's a professional joke in the statistics world, which is that it's not bias if you call it Bayesian. And I've always found that funny, even if I don't totally understand the joke. Bayesian stats to me is interesting and a little challenging. For other listeners who aren't familiar with that, it's in contrast to frequentist statistics, which is the p-value system you're all used to hearing. Bayesian just kind of gives you a little bit different way of trying to absorb the magnitude of an effect and the probability of an effect of changing an outcome. So as opposed to, you know, a dichotomous way of looking at it, which has been criticized for a lot of reasons, but subject for another podcast. Yeah, I don't know what to make of this. Again, it seems like more, even with the fancy Bayesian statistics and the kind of clever way of maybe trying to massage the results, which I do not think is what the authors were trying to do, I think it's really hard to look at this trial and significantly tip the scales towards tocilizumab having a major benefit. I think for a therapy like this, what you're most interested in, especially with this cost, is mortality. If there was a clear mortality benefit, the cost would be worth it. The effort would be worth it, limited effort, but generally speaking. You know, for a health services outcome, let's say you really did, tocilizumab really did dramatically reduce the amount of patients that needed critical care. I think that would be a result worthy of note, but with you'd have to have a different, you know, benefit profile in terms of, and that would have to include, I think, cost. $2,500, you know, per dose, per patient, for two doses times thousands of patients isn't going to be sustainable for a limited, marginal, likely narrow benefit in my mind.
But we're doing it for remdesivir.
Yeah, Remdesivir, boy, you know, talk about the way the winds have shifted. You know, back in March, masks didn't work either, and now it's all we have. It's tough. I agree. It seems like our institutional protocols still call for Remdesivir. And interestingly, we really don't lean on tocilizumab. You guys had a great discussion about that on one of your prior pods, but yeah, it's tough. I just don't see this significantly shifting us towards increased use of tocilizumab. What I see this as doing is shifting, the trials that attempt to use tocilizumab towards an enriched group. So maybe using some sort of greater declarate, you know, some way of better quantifying inflammation. Those with higher inflammation or particularly early disease may be considering use, but more likely, you know, still relegated to clinical trials for routine use.
Mm-hmm. I think one interesting thing about this study was that 33% of patients in the tocilizumab arm got glucocorticoids versus 61% in the usual care arm, which is a pretty big difference, and I think maybe shows the dangers of an open label trial. Because if you know the results of the recovery trial and your patient isn't getting the experimental drug, I mean, you're probably going to want to give them some steroids if it's allowed. And so I think, you know, that could potentially bias toward a negative result. But I think overall, you know, in the presence of steroids or not, it didn't seem to have a big impact. So we already talked on previous episodes about the Back Bay trial. That was a placebo-controlled, randomized controlled trial that had a negative outcome. They were looking at mechanical ventilation or death within 28 days, and it was negative. And then last week, we reviewed the EMPACTA trial, which was published in the New England Journal. That's another placebo-controlled trial. It was a little larger with 389 patients. And their primary outcome was mechanical ventilation or death within 28 days. And they did find a significant difference. It was 12% for tocilizumab versus 19% for the placebo group, but there was no difference in mortality at 28 days. And so even though it was statistically significant, it doesn't really seem like a very robust outcome. As Austin alluded to, Josh Farkas has a nice write-up of these trials on his blog. And he mentioned that, you know, when you're doing these survival analysis, it evaluates the number of events and also how rapidly they occur. And they combine both of those findings into the final p-value. But from a clinical standpoint, the hardest endpoint is simply whether or not the patient dies or is intubated. We don't really care when that happens. And so, you know, if you look at just the number of clinical failures, irrespective of that timing, the p-value ends up being more like 0.08, which would not be statistically significant, for whatever that's worth. And then I didn't realize, what were you going to say?
What if we use Bayesian statistics here?
Bayesian. Said it wrong.
That's where I'm at.
Yeah. We're just a couple of rubes, some simple country internists. We don't know about this Bayesian stuff.
I think what I really hear when I put my ear to the ground is a meta-analysis coming. And meta-analysis is going to be will be interesting and challenging. One colleague refers to a meta-analysis like a barrel of wine. It can be a barrel of wine, but if you put one bad bottle in, it poisons the whole well. Interestingly, lots of randomized controlled trials to look at. You know, we'll see if that gives it the power to reach some significant conclusion. It does seem that the one thing that's consistent across the trials is potentially reducing the rate of disease progression, but also seems consistent that mortality isn't clearly affected either. So. Yeah. But that's my prediction.
Well, here's the thing, though. So while I was reading these articles, I didn't realize that there was another large double-blinded placebo-controlled trial for tocilizumab called COVACTA. I don't know if you guys have heard of this one. It has not been published yet. There's a preprint up, apparently. It's been up since September, so I don't know why it's not published yet. But that one's sponsored by Roche. And they had already announced that it did fail to meet its predefined efficacy thresholds. There was no mortality difference at day 28. but the time to hospital discharge was shorter, 20 days versus 28 days. So maybe we'll revisit that one when it gets published. But then last week, the British government issued new guidance encouraging healthcare providers to use two arthritis drugs to treat severely sick COVID-19 patients after the REMAP CAP trial published their preprint data. Because apparently that's how science works now in the COVID era. You just throw up a preprint before the article gets peer reviewed and published, and then, you know, tantalize everybody. I only skimmed the abstract for this REMAP CAP trial. They were comparing tocilizumab and sarilumab, another IL-6 inhibitor, to usual care. So it's not placebo controlled, but they were doing it in ICU patients with COVID-19. And that's where this trial is different. All the other ones were basically non-ICU patients. They were looking specifically at critically ill patients. And their outcome was mortality. And it was 22% for tocilizumab, 28% for sarilumab, and 35.8% for usual care, which was statistically significant for both drugs. So four mostly negative studies, and then this one swoops in with like a mortality benefit in ICU patients. I don't know. I think I'm with you, Jason. Let's wait for the meta-analysis. I don't know.
Also, it'll be really interesting. Oh, go ahead, Austin.
88% of those patients got Dex, so I think that still is part of this muddled equation.
Mm. It would be interesting to know, you know, maybe there really is some synergistic effect with the two meds. Maybe too, the trials that we're talking about today are all pretty small. Critical care trials are pretty famously underpowered. So it could be that a meta-analysis or a larger, robust trial is going to show us something that is meaningful. I think the flip side of this, which we haven't mentioned much so far in this discussion, is that there really aren't a lot of downsides other than cost to tocilizumab. There's no consistent harm profile, and there doesn't appear to be a lot of complications. And you know, maybe especially in Western developed countries where a lot of resources are getting devoted to COVID, maybe we will see kind of more widespread use or some cost pressure that does make it, you know, not to make it all about cost. The most important thing is saving lives. If it saves lives, we should use it. But, you know, especially if some other factors around tocilizumab change, you know, might become significantly more advantageous.
Are you seeing it used at all in any of the ICUs that you rotate in? VA, IHC, U of U?
We're seeing it. People are getting it. I think it's a challenge. I think for people who are listening who are wondering what to do, I think your first step is to follow whatever your institutional protocol is, which is probably going to include dexamethasone, maybe remdesivir, despite the concerns. I think if there's a clinical trial available after that, I think that should be your next stop. If it's a relatively, if it's a patient, in my mind, that is early in their disease course, you know, severe inflammation, you know, as manifested by, you know, overwhelming ARDS in the ICU, those are the patients I think it's worthwhile considering the use of tocilizumab. And yeah, the patient that comes to the floor or even the moderate patient in the ICU, I think the evidence just isn't there to be aggressive with it. You know, except maybe they have a contraindication to steroids, which is uncommon, or, you know, they can't get remdesivir or one of the other therapies, you know, especially if they're not a candidate for a clinical trial. I think you have enough evidence to say that tocilizumab isn't harmful in most patients, and therefore might be worthwhile in that scenario as well. But we're definitely seeing it kind of complicated, comes and goes with the you know, the most recent trial that's been published and how people feel about it. We're all trying to adjust on the fly to all this too. It's been tough.
Yeah, cool. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Jason. You added a lot of good info and context. So thanks for joining us after a long clinic day.
My pleasure.
And thank you, Austin, for taking some time out of your paternal duties to help educate the world.
And for showing us baby Gus.
Yeah, he's a handsome guy. All right. Well, we'll be back next week. We'll see you.